Lush Life, the Billy Strayhorn story. The year 1999. A dusty book-lined room in the Smithsonian Ellington Archives, with stacks of manuscripts and folders on library tables. Only the quiet rustling of manuscript pages being turned breaks the silence. Peering over his glasses, an aging music scholar remarks to his assistant that several pieces credited to Duke Ellington bear the unmistakable imprint of Billy Strayhorn. Others are simply unknown from his recorded works. He isolates one obviously special piece, dated 1933 in Strayhorn's own hand. The two move their chairs closer together and scrutinize the document. The scholar is intrigued that such a sophisticated piece could have been created when Strayhorn was in high school. He is reminded that Strayhorn was in his teens when he wrote the magnificent Lush Life. He realizes the piece is unknown, never before recorded. His assistant tentatively begins to hum the beautiful waltz, and they smile. After the first pass, the two are nearly giddy, as if they had discovered a lost treasure from the crypts of the pharaohs. More than 60 years after it was written, Waltz made its belated debut to an adoring public, eager for a glimpse into the private world of an American master. Within a year of its rediscovery, the lovely waltz was recorded, written about in scholarly journals, and used to cast an impressionistic spell over a scene in a feature film. Much of what we celebrate in life is the result of unseen forces. This was Billy Strayhorn. The mere mention of Strayhorn's name has always elicited a special reverence among musicians. He was the real thing. He was what songwriters aspired to when they took up the craft. He lived life with style, grace, and passion. But he was black and gay. Rather than indulging the common practice of obscuring his sexuality behind the camouflage of meaningless female companions, Strayhorn insisted on appearing with whomever he pleased. In music and in life, he created his own reality, whatever the surrounding environment. The world would have to meet him on his terms, or not at all. America would fall in love with Strayhorn's music, but preferred to treat Strayhorn the man as invisible. Strayhorn composed much of the music associated with one of the 20th century's greatest musical icons, Duke Ellington. Take the A-Train, Lush Life, and Satin Doll have been performed by artists as diverse as Ella Fitzgerald, Tony Bennett, and Queen Latifah. Yet during his lifetime, few knew his name. In a stroke of poetic justice, a best-selling biography, new recordings of his works, and even features on network news programs have begun to push the reluctant genius onto center stage. Over the years, musicians, fans, and family members have kept alive through oral tradition the transcendent story of Strayhorn's struggles and triumphs in an environment pointedly hostile to black culture and to homosexuality. The Billy Strayhorn story is powerful and poetic, at once personal, intimate, and grand. Ellington Strayhorn is the surreal intersection where music scholars and juke joints convene. The anecdotes are rich. Strayhorn and Ellington were opposites. Ellington, the luminescent showman. Strayhorn, the cerebral architect. Ellington, the notorious purveyor of romance, for whom women were a delicacy to be sampled but never fully digested. Strayhorn, intensely monogamous. Yet as collaborators, Ellington and Strayhorn, as writers, Ellington and Strayhorn, painting a landscape of complementary colors, an unprecedented and sublime musical communion. Ellington Strayhorn collaboration was one of the most complex and creatively productive in music history. Strayhorn worked in the shadow of an artist whose fame extended to the farthest outposts of the musical universe. Ellington has sometimes been praised as Strayhorn's musical benefactor or facilitator, and sometimes damned for adorning himself with Strayhorn's anonymous musical gifts. The relationship was iridescent. From one perspective, Ellington, 16 years Strayhorn senior, was a generous mentor who, rather than paying Strayhorn a salary, provided him with all of life's necessities, as well as the accoutrements of success. Alternatively, Ellington's ostensible largesse was seen as the handiwork of a wolf in shepherd's clothing, with Duke having helped himself to undeserved credit and one half of Strayhorn's massive songwriting catalog. Their 30-year history was a symbiotic mix of mutual creative invigoration and selfless support, punctuated by periods of neglect, competition, and resentment. Ultimately, their collaboration was one of reciprocal adoration, and it produced a cultural triumph. In the best of times, artists face monumental struggles for recognition, acceptance, and respect. In mid-century America, there was cultural hand-to-hand combat. Black artists were barred from prestigious venues, excluded from civilized accommodations, and were paid fees a fraction of those paid to their white counterparts. Yet they produced music of enduring beauty and passion. In an ironic twist, this music helped to legitimize American culture to a European community skeptical that Americans could create anything of value. The overflowing, integrated concert halls of Europe stand in contrast to the segregated facilities these artists endured at home in America. These were men of refined sensibilities and demeanor who, in some quarters, were worshipped as musical gods, but routinely forced to urinate roadside throughout the American South. This was an era when black culture emerged from the shadows to shape American music, fashion, dance, and language. Writers, painters, poets, and the avant-garde of Hollywood made pilgrimages to Harlem to absorb a life of jazz and cocktails, and to draw from the seemingly endless creative wellspring. Harlem undulated. Music cascaded out of the stylish brownstones into the streets, where it commingled with the cacophony of urban life. The decor was Art Deco. The scene is urbane, articulate, intelligent, soulful. Men wore hats and spoke a strange language, a secret code that would infiltrate and enliven standard English. The music that defined the era was Ellington and Strayhorn. Together, they were the prime architects of a new sound that would change everything. When the music swung, it was hot. But in the hours halfway to dawn, there were achingly beautiful laments of love and life.
I have almost everything a human could desire. cars and houses, bearskin rugs to lie before my fire. But there's something missing, something isn't there. It seems I'm never kissing the one whom I could care for. Adventurous dream.
Black people are the ultimate outsiders in America. But in delicious irony, black culture stood the caste system on its head and established the standards for cool. What was excluded became an item to emulate. Billy Strayhorn, black, homosexual, and sensitive, talented, marginalized, is the outsider's outsider. Even though to the public he was virtually anonymous, Strayhorn's vibrancy and multi-layered brilliance made him an irresistible figure within the creative community. Quick-witted, handsome, and well-read, Strayhorn could hypnotize a room with conversation or music. Lena Horne described Billy as the only man she ever really loved. Lana Turner was similarly enthralled. There are those who maintain that Strayhorn found comfort and safety away from the public glare that surrounded Ellington. But his unrealized need for artistic recognition was an inescapable dissonance throughout his life. The year 1915. Billy's parents looked down with resignation at a sickly newborn, and then at each other. Billy was born in such poor health that his parents, not expecting him to survive, failed to name him for the first 4 months of his life. The withholding of baby boy Strayhorn's name was to be the precursor throughout his life. As the world danced, laughed, and made love to his music, Billy's professional name was demoted to the status of mere footnote. Whether through neglect or malevolence, the mere absence or obliteration of his name was inadequate to still Strayhorn's spirit. The father, James Strayhorn, in a rare moment of paternal frivolity, roughhouses with Billy's older brother in the living room of their childhood home. Tired of the game, James collapses on the sofa. He notices the half-closed door to Billy's room. Framed in the doorway, he scrutinizes his bookish, quiet son. A son who has no interest in roughhousing. Books and papers are strewn across the bed. 10-year-old Billy sprawls on the floor, his back to the door, unaware of his father's presence. Billy hums a tune while he thumbs through a book. He lingers over a page, takes his spectacles off, places them carefully on the floor next to him, and rubs his eyes. Feeling a presence, he turns a little and over his shoulder reads the disgust and malice on his father's face. Father and son. Their eyes lock as the father deliberately grinds Billy's glasses into the floor with the heel of his shoe. Billy is still unreadable. Strayhorn's creative imperative was undeterred by the virulent aura of his embittered father. As a boy, Strayhorn sought asylum from his father's cruel disapproval in a private world of music of otherworldly beauty. Billy had a mystical way of composing. Billy's mother Lillian, apron-clad and efficient, administers at the stove. Children run in and out of the kitchen, howling and jostling one another. Mama scolds to no avail. The screen door slams. Billy sits at the kitchen table, humming to himself. Without benefit of a piano, he commits notes to paper. Buddha's solitude in a crowd. In insistent defiance of his surroundings, he summons the early strains of Lotus Blossom. The ethereal notes faintly punctuate the moment. The racket recedes, and the music prevails, revealing the song's intimate beauty. In many ways, this is a classic American saga of a young artist going to New York to conquer the world. Strayhorn mastered composition before he left Pittsburgh. As a young man, he dreamed of becoming a classical pianist, an absurd notion for a black man in the era. In 1938, on a December afternoon before a performance in Pittsburgh, a local jazz fan introduced Billy to Duke Ellington. Informed that Strayhorn was a talented writer and pianist, Ellington invited Billy to the piano to show what he could do. The theater dressing room. Ellington sits with imperial indifference as attendants shave him and ready his wardrobe, hair, and execute the precise requirements of his pre-performance meal. Strayhorn respectfully reproduces note for note the Ellington solo of Sophisticated Lady from the previous night's concert. Strayhorn then announces, "And Mr. Ellington, this is how I would play it." What follows is a tour de force that explores the subtle textures and nuances of the song as written, and then tests the harmonic boundaries as if the song were being written on the spot. By the time the 23-year-old Strayhorn plays his second number, Ellington has summoned his inner circle of band members who listen in awe. Ellington, half-shaved, stands looking over Billy's shoulder and listens silently, studying this diminutive, bespeckled young man. Soon after, Ellington invites Strayhorn to New York. In the late 1930s, New York began to awaken from the long night of the Great Depression and lean toward a moment of triumph and splendor. But with the rise of fascism in Europe, the threat of war was in the air. A crowded subway train in New York. The train sways with a rhythmic clacking on the rails. Black teenagers, loud and full of themselves, play the dozens. Society matrons with hats and patent leather handbags, foreheads almost touching, chatter and gesture with their white-gloved hands. A young married couple argue heatedly in a foreign language. Suited businessmen with briefcases and shiny black shoes sub-vocalize to one another. Babies wail. A tiny old lady with shopping bags sits down beside and nestles up to Billy. Amidst the noise and the distractions, the drama of the subway, Billy retreats to his private world and converts Duke's directions to Harlem into lyrics for the immortal Take the A-Train.
Hurry, 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 take the A-Train to find the quickest way to get to Harlem.
No song better characterized America's energy and willful refusal to submit to wartime gloom than the joyous A-Train. Ironically, the song is commonly thought to have been composed by Ellington. The collaboration between Duke and Billy was telepathic. Two pianos on opposite sides of a room. The last rays of an autumn evening stream through the window. the young Strayhorn plays the first four bars of Star-Crossed Lovers, ending with a pregnant pause. Cautiously, Duke's Debussy-like chords complete the musical phrase like a brilliant student who correctly answers the teacher's trick question. Billy then delivers the melodic punchline, slow and sensual. Not a word spoken. Ellington, wings expanded, ascends on the swell of a Strayhorn updraft. A moment when the student becomes the teacher. Racial lines were precise and rigid in the years prior to World War II. But change was inevitable. Radio broadcasts of the music of black artists along with the triumphs of black athletes gained entry into the homes and psyches of white Americans and began to create a new sensibility. A small group of white teenagers with crew cuts, striped t-shirts, and blue jeans with big cuffs and high-top gym shoes huddle around a wooden radio. Several throw imaginary punches as the announcer describes Joe Louis's first-round knockout of Max Schmeling. The network returns to its regular programming, a live broadcast of an Ellington performance. The celebration continues with the volume discreetly turned down so as not to attract parental attention or parental wrath. Grasping an ornate 1930-style microphone with both hands, the announcer struggles to be heard above the partiers as he introduces Ellington's Coco. What the teenagers don't know, but what their parents dimly perceive, is the unstoppable insinuation into their lives of two very disparate but powerful influences from the forbidden worlds of Negroes. That of sports and music, which would forever change their way of being, would forever change America. 3 years after Louis defeated Schmeling, broadcasts of the orchestra's new theme song, Strayhorn's Take the A-Train, would be interrupted by a news flash that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. Duke and Billy helped to create a new musical sound to which America involuntarily began to move. The Savoy Ballroom, a subversive pagan ritual, is at its most delicious. Polyrhythmic drums, outlandish yet disciplined horns, and interracial swing dancing. Heels and skirts airborne, jet black legs and white ankle socks. Strayhorn collaborated with Orson Welles on musical theater and co-wrote the startling soundtrack for Otto Preminger's Anatomy of a Murder. In the film, Strayhorn plays a piece off the set while Jimmy Stewart is the front man playing it on screen. An act of ventriloquism which mirrors much of Billy's creative and professional life. The 1950s. Their 20-year collaboration has taken Ellington and Strayhorn all over the world and established jazz as the great American music. After struggling for entree into prestigious venues at home, an Ellington concert is finally scheduled for Carnegie Hall. Strayhorn has excitedly informed friends of the premiere of a new work he co-wrote with Duke for the occasion. Unknown to Billy, Joe Morgan, Duke's publicist, has removed his credit. Halfway through the first number, Billy examines the concert program and discovers that his name has been omitted. Embarrassed, Billy slips out for a smoke. Through the stage door, he can hear the faint sounds of the music as it spills into the street. The night is illuminated only by the muted blue lights in the distance and their reflection from the wet-bricked alley. Billy leans back against the building as smoke drifts from a cigarette. Aaron Bridgers, his companion, seeks him out and begs him to come inside. Billy declines and dryly remarks, "This night belongs to Edward." The two disappear into the night, Aaron's arm on Billy's shoulder. Alcohol was both indispensable to celebrating the best of times and the anesthetic that muted Billy's private torture. Strayhorn's apartment was legendary for its stylish decor, but most of all, for its warm, welcoming atmosphere. Billy loved to cook for his friends, and his place was where musicians, writers, and various dilettantes convened.
Where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails. The girls I knew had sad and sullen gray faces with distant K-traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day 12 o'clock tales.
Over time, the ritual became further removed from its meaning, a convenient antidote to an increasingly dim reality. The cocktail became a talisman of surrender. The early 60s, Billy's beautiful New York apartment. Billy is in the kitchen making up his famous baked beans and beer combination. The ubiquitous cigarette hangs from Billy's mouth. He dances and jokes with his friends while serving up the endless quantities of food and booze. There are, as usual, wall-to-wall people. Lena, Martin Luther King, musicians and writers. Off in a corner, there's a spirited debate about freedom riders and lunch counters. The music is loud and joyful. Laughter. Billy quotes Shakespeare, intermixed with street metaphors as clever comebacks to the jokes and the conversations of his friends. Everyone is as high on the energy of the moment as on the drinks. Outside the window, the sun sidles up over the horizon, first light in the morning sky. We hear the echoes down the hallway of the last guests leaving as Billy shuts the door. The phone rings. "Hello, Edward. Ellington is calling from somewhere in Europe. Man, they're loving us over here. I got this idea. Listen." Billy listens intently to the few notes from a piano over the phone. Then he says, "Now you listen." And he puts the receiver on the piano as he extends and embellishes what Duke has started. He picks up the phone again. Duke laughs. "You got it, man. See if you can have it ready for the band by next Tuesday. Gotta run." Billy hangs up and surveys the leavings of the party. He empties an ashtray and takes plates off the coffee table and puts them in the kitchen sink. He sinks down on the sofa, puts his feet on the coffee table to watch the sun come up. He takes a final drink from a half-filled glass. Hours later, he awakens and tries again to drain the last ounce. He laughs quietly to himself and shakes his head slowly when he discovers that the glass is empty. He lights up a cigarette and hums a tune as he starts to compose on a piece of paper. By Tuesday, the song will be a masterpiece. "51 years old, and at the peak of his creative vigor, Strayhorn is diagnosed with esophageal cancer. Years of cigarettes and alcohol have demanded their due. As if in a race with his diminishing resources, Strayhorn composed some of his greatest songs. A hospital room. Billy basks in the simple pleasures of the company of kindred souls. Lena Horne cares for Billy as she would her child, feeding him, carefully wiping his chin, tucking the sheets and blankets around him. Strayhorn's companion, Bill Grove, is a paragon of devotion. He watches and waits. As his strength wanes, Billy is granted his first concert under his own name, a debut and finale in a single evening. In the final days, Bill Grove encounters the strictures of hospital regulations in his attempt to remain by Strayhorn's side. After a series of rebuffs by petty officials, a sage senior nurse discreetly ushers him to Strayhorn's bedside. In his private moments, physically weakened and pianoless, Strayhorn composes the poignant requiem, Blood Count. Ellington speaks at Billy's funeral with the eloquence and tenderness of his greatest composition. St. Peter's Church in Manhattan is filled with the famous and the unknown for whom the loss is personal and irreplaceable. Billy's ashes are scattered on the Hudson River at one of his favorite venues, the Boat Basin. On the one-year anniversary of his death, a small group assemble at the Boat Basin to remember their friend. When a boatman asks why they are there, they explain, and are informed, that another man had just come by. In the distance, they see Ellington, alone, walking along the Hudson in silent tribute. Duke walks into the mist.